Hello and welcome to another edition of the Men with the Golden Tongues. I am your host, Micah, joined by my co-host, Brad.
Congratulations, everyone. You're here for what might be the most perfect spy movie ever created.
We are here to talk about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one for me. I love this movie. Like you said, this might be a perfect spy movie.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Like there's really nothing. There's very little you can critique about it, and anything that you can critique feels nitpicky.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah.
Which is funny because like this movie, like it's written by the director, Christopher McQuarrie. And it is written by him with a screenplay by him with a story from him and Drew Pearce. And the story, they kind of reverse engineered it.
They did. It's funny because I when you kind of look into the background of this film, both Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise talk about the fact that when they started, they basically had like the action scenes like planned out and storyboarded. And then not much else. Like, they literally changed the conclusion of the film on the fly because how they originally envisioned it, once they kind of looked at it and kind of evaluated it within the context of the entire film, they're like, well, this doesn't feel quite right. So let's completely change the ending of the movie and how the film resolves in order to, you know, because of what we experienced while filming, it just doesn't feel like the right ending that we've chosen up front, which is amazing. To do it. It's a good thing they did because it lends itself nicely to the next Mission Impossible movie, which we'll be reviewing in a couple of months.
Yeah, yeah. So this movie stars Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt, Jeremy Renner as William Brandt, Simon Pegg as Benji Dunn, Rebecca Ferguson as Ilsa Faust, Ving Rhames as Luther Stickle, Sean Harris as Solomon Lane, and a whole slew of other people. And this film, everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody is playing a part. Tom Cruise is officially a video game character in this movie. he's been creeping up to it, you know, but this is it, right? Like he's got unlimited grip strength, you know what I mean? He's awesome in this movie. This is very clearly his midlife crisis, like, franchise.
It's so funny because all the shit that happens in this film, like, I think they get literally as close to the line as you can. Like, they keep one foot kind of, or not even a foot, they keep one toe kind of planted in reality to some extent so that you don't have to completely, you know, like, take the leap of faith to suspend your disbelief. Like, they give you the slightest bit to grab onto, but man, do they, you know, just take it as like literally a millimeter away from the line between just completely ostentatiously ridiculous and what they have here.
And I think a lot of that has to do with Tom Cruise like insisting on doing his own stuff.
Oh, sure. And the fact that they used, you know, that they do practical stunt work.
Yeah.
Where possible.
Yeah.
Including, like I said, from the get-go in this film, which is insane.
Yeah. So the film opens up in Minsk, with the Impossible Mission Force agents, William Brandt, directing two members of his team, Benji and Luther.
Name me a film, by the way, that in this like 5 minute span that this pre-credit sequence, you know, takes up, name me a film that is so effectively able to so accurately convey like the individual personalities of these four different characters in this very short sequence. Like I said, it's so good. It's so good. So
yeah. I think that's, you know, that's another strength that this has. Perhaps over the Bond franchises, that the characters, like you said, are very well defined, and you know, they're archetypes, but you know, archetypes exist for a reason. Like they play those roles very, very well. And it is like they all have very good chemistry.
It helps that this is actually the first film in the franchise, which is hard to believe, where every member of the team is actually returning from a previous Mission Impossible movie. So these are at least all established characters. We're not meeting anybody new for the first time yet.
Yeah, which is cool, man. So Brandt is directing Benji and Luther because they're trying to retrieve a package from an AM-400 Airbus or something like that?
A giant cargo plane, basically.
Yeah. And you know, they're bickering and you see their personalities come through, right? Like Luther is in like Malaysia or something like that.
He's not even technically on the mission.
Right.
He's just providing like remote assistance upon Benji's request, basically. Right. And then Brandt is at HQ. He's in Quantico or whatever part of Virginia that the IMF conducts operations from.
And Luther is connecting Benji to the plane's electronics by hacking a Russian satellite, and Brandt reminds them that, you know, everybody's, you know, already under investigation for misconduct. So it's like, are you sure you should be doing this? And they're trying to hurry up and get this stuff before the plane leaves. And the plane's engines start. Like, the plane is ready for takeoff, right? And Benji's like, I'm not really ready yet, and I can't shut the plane down. And all of a sudden, you see our hero, Ethan Hunt, and he comes in
up here on a hillside.
I mean, this is the most like
it's like the reverse Moses. Like, he's coming up from the valley instead of coming down from the mountaintop to come in and save the day.
He's that's exactly an apt comparison. He's like some sort of spy messiah throughout this movie. And like that one shot of him coming up, it's like, I imagine that one shot of him on the hillside looking off in the distance is like his Tom Cruise's wallpaper on his computer. And he runs down the plane, right? Because, I mean, look, it's not a Mission Impossible movie. Hell, it's not a Tom Cruise movie if he's not sprinting at something. And he sprints over the hill by the runway, and he jumps onto the wing of the plane, and he's like, "Open the door, Benji!" And Benji opens the wrong door. Like, I love this series because it bounces its seriousness and its comedy really well. And Tom Cruise, the plane is taking off, and Tom Cruise is hanging on the plane. Now, this plane is legit taking off, and that is legit Tom Cruise that you see hanging off the side of it. And it gets up to like 5,000 feet.
Yeah, he's a maniac. He's fucking crazy person. Tom Cruise is. Here's a fun trivia fact that I discovered. When this movie was filmed, okay, when Mission Impossible 5 was being filmed, Tom Cruise was 5 years younger than John Voight was when the first Mission Impossible was filmed. Jeez. And you remember how fucking old and decrepit John Voight looked in the first Mission Impossible. Goodness. And he was only in his mid-50s. And meanwhile, Tom Cruise is hanging off the side of airplanes.
You're a good boy. I mean, this Scientology thing might be worth it.
I mean, again, we said it before, Tom Cruise is going to be making these fucking films into his 70s. And he's going to be doing the same bullshit that he's doing. Again, this is the fifth one. And he's like, I got to amp it up. We've been too tame in the stunts that we've been doing so far. Like, I need to really get out there and do something wild. What if I hang on to the side of a plane? And they're like, well, we can CG this, Tom. Like, it would be very easy to do. He's like, no, I'm going to hang on the side of a fucking plane that's taking off. Like, they literally had to design special contact lenses for him. Because obviously, if you're hanging on the side of a plane and like a fucking fly comes along and whacks you in the face, it's going to take out your goddamn eyeball.
Right, right. What about the birds, right? You can throw birds to not fly in your airspace.
And didn't he injure himself during this stunt too? Like, didn't he like mess up his ankle or something?
He injured himself 6 times during the filming of this movie. And in order to one up himself, he's going to want to do it 8 times by Mission Impossible.
Right.
Yeah, it's a wild stunt, and it's a pre-credit scene. Like,
I know.
like this pre-credit scene story-wise has like a point to it for the rest of the film, but yo, it's a pre-credit scene. And this is something that's usually reserved for like the
signature action set piece.
Yeah. And they're just like, nah, let's just knock this out in the first 10 minutes. It's wild, man.
This is his like I said, the equivalent Bond wise has to be the ski jump, right?
Yeah.
With the parachute opening. And that wasn't even, it's not like Roger Moore did that shit. Like they had they had a professional skier fucking do that.
So Benji eventually opens the right door, and Ethan is able to get in. And the particular MacGuffin that we're looking for in this pre-credit scene is a pallet full of nerve gas. And the Russian guys come back because they hear something, and they come back, and the way the camera work is done, it's like the Russian guy doesn't see anything, and then he turns his back, and then he turns around again, and you see Tom Cruise sitting there like the cat that just swallowed the canary, and he looks over, and he's and the Russian guy's like, hey, wait a minute, and Tom Cruise
he literally like shrugs at him, basically he's like, oh, gotta go.
Oh shit. And then that's it. That is the pre-credit scene. The Mission Impossible theme, which I you know, the Bond theme is great, but I love the Mission Impossible.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
It's fun.
So whereas the Bond theme is the theme music that you want in your life when you're just walking around doing everyday shit being cool, like this is the Mission Impossible theme is the theme you want when you're actually like actively doing spying, basically, or covert work.
Yeah, when I'm getting pumped up and feeling badass, that's what you play. Yeah. So the nerve gas was being sold to a terrorist group, but none of the people who sent it from Belarus had a means to obtain it. And Ethan is convinced this trail would lead him to the Syndicate. Now, the Syndicate is Mission Impossible's version of Spectre. Mm-hmm. It is an international crime consortium whose very existence has been in doubt. Like, nobody believes that the Syndicate exists.
Yeah, basically the CIA thinks that Ethan Hunt is a crazy person.
Yeah, and they have all the evidence in the world. Because he's hanging off of planes and shit.
Now, like I said, the opening scene proper of the film is the kind of shit that you and I love, especially when it's like, legit like spy stuff, when you have like, you know, like a code phrase back and forth with a deep cover operative, apparently, you know, receiving a mission on a vinyl record as a callback to the original TV show.
Oh, right.
As well, which is kind of neat. But yeah, like I said, Tom Cruise goes into a record store in London. The clerk there, who's an IMF like deep cover agent, I guess, is fangirling a little bit over Ethan Hunt.
I would too if fucking Spy Jesus walked into the record shop. and you know, they do all the cloak and dagger stuff, and you know, they do all the passwords and stuff, and Ethan gets his mission, and he starts to play it on vinyl, and the vinyl is explaining what's going on, and the vinyl is like, the syndicate exists, and we know it exists because we're the syndicate, dummy. And we got you.
Good evening, Mr. Hunt. The weapons you recovered in Belarus were confirmed to be VX nerve gas, capable of devastating a major city. The bodies of the air crew were found less than 24 hours after they landed in Damascus. They were identified as low-level Chechen separatists, with neither the access nor the ability to acquire the weapons they were transporting. This would support your suspicion that a shadow organization is committed to inciting revolution by enabling acts of terror in nations friendly to Western interests. IMF suspects this to be the same shadow organization you have been tracking for the last year, also known as the Syndicate. IMF would be right. Normally, you and your team would be tasked with infiltrating and disrupting this terrorist network, but we have taken steps to ensure that this will not happen. Because we are the Syndicate, Mr. Hunt, and now we know who you are. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to face your fate. Pursue us, you will be caught. Resist us, you will be killed. And your precious secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. Good luck, Mr. Hunt. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And it turns out, like, this was all a trap. And Ethan is locked off from the rest of the record store, but through a see-through wall. But all of a sudden, he gets up to the wall. Gas starts coming out, and he sees this figure come from behind the IMF agent that was assisting him. Ethan sees that guy shoot the IMF agent. And then Ethan gets knocked out as the gas kind of takes its effect.
This is cool. It's actually shocking that a trope like this took like 5 films to get to, because it's taking, you know, something that's very familiar and established and normal and turning it on its head. It was very unexpected the first time you watch the movie, because the recording kind of goes into it so casually. Like it much starts off like a traditional, you know, IMF briefing, and then kind of turns on its head immediately. Like we are left to react at the same time that Ethan does, essentially.
Yeah. Which, you know, you got to shake things up.
Yeah.
Like, these movies are predictable enough that, you know, you got to shake things up. You got to move some of the pieces around just to kind of keep it fresh. Meanwhile, Brandt is with CIA Director Alan Hunley, played by Alec Baldwin. Who I like Alec Baldwin.
I remember when when he first showed up here, I was like, man, what a peculiar choice to get Alec Baldwin. Like he's too, like, Alec Baldwin is an effortlessly funny person. Like he can be funny in being serious sometimes. And we forget that he's a dramatic actor. So like, or can be. So like I said, it was a very odd choice. But his, like, he has some of the best lines in this film, especially when he gets the monologue. It's really exciting. Yeah. And that's how you can tell, that he was a good choice for this particular role.
Oh my God. At the end where he's describing Ethan Hunt to the one guy, I'm just like, yo, come on. Like, there's something about Alec Baldwin's delivery with everything he says. It's so dry that it feels like he's being sarcastic all the time, but he's being serious, but you don't really know. Like, I love Alec Baldwin in this movie. Seems like the best type of boss to have.
It's fun. By the way, did you think that the chairman of the Senate subcommittee that him and Brandt are talking to was the same guy from the XCOM games? Because he has like the identical voice basically of the XCOM. Like I literally had to IMDb it, because I was like, this has to be the XCOM guy. He's got the same fucking voice. It's not the same guy, but I could have sworn that it would have been.
That's hilarious.
So
So Brandt and Director Hunley are sitting there before the Senate Oversight Committee, and Brandt must respond to every question by refusing to confirm or deny anything without permission from the secretary.
Who's dead.
Who is dead.
Yeah, right. We saw that happen last film.
This allows Hunley to kind of have his way with the committee.
Mr. Chairman, the IMF's misadventures date back to my earliest days at the CIA when the IMF broke into the CIA to steal a list of covert operatives. And now, more recently, a Russian warhead.
Disarmed Russian warhead.
A Russian nuclear warhead.
Rendered safe by the IMF.
Clipped the Transamerica pyramid before plunging into the San Francisco Bay.
Saving the Western Hemisphere.
This made possible by IMF agents who did willingly provide the launch codes to a known terrorist. Do I have that right, Agent Brandt?
I can neither confirm nor deny details of any such operation without the Secretary's approval.
This was the same week that the IMF infiltrated the Kremlin. Here is the Kremlin before. And the Kremlin after.
I can neither confirm nor deny details of any operation
without the Secretary's approval. Yes, we know. In fact, until this panel appoints a new Secretary, you really can't say much of anything, can you, Agent Brandt?
Well, I didn't write the rules, Mr. Hunley.
Mr. Chairman, the so-called Impossible Mission Force is not just a rogue organization. It is an outdated one, a throwback to an era without transparency and without oversight.
Mr. Chairman.
The time has come to dissolve the IMF.
Mr. Chairman.
And transfer their salvageable assets to the CIA.
Mr. Chairman, the IMF has operated without oversight for 40 years.
Chairman.
Now, are its methods unorthodox?
Mr.
Yes.
Chairman.
Are its results less than perfect? Absolutely. But without the IMF,
there will be order and stability.
Without the IMF.
This panel recognizes the IMF's contribution to global security. But the events laid out by CIA Director Hunley also show a pattern of wanton brinksmanship and a total disregard for protocol. From where I sit, your unorthodox methods are indistinguishable from chance. And your results, perfect or not, look suspiciously like luck. I'm afraid today is the day when the IMF's luck runs out.
And Hunley gets up there and he's like, yeah, the Impossible Mission Force is... they're ridiculous. This is ludicrous, right? Like... just one movie ago, here's the Kremlin before the IMF, and here's the Kremlin after the IMF, and it's just
those are two different pictures. Those are like that's not even the same building. That's CIA trickery right there.
And Hunley is like, yo, the impossible. First of all, the name is stupid. That's one reason to get rid of it. It's called the Impossible Mission Force, and two, they have had no oversight, just allowed to do whatever they want. And the Senate, the Oversight Committee is like, yeah, you know, you get results, but like I'm not in a position to believe that those results that you get are more than just dumb luck.
I mean, look, in fairness.
but look, that's what I like about this, right? Like They do call out the fact that, you know, a lot of this spy stuff, I mean, we're just kind of winging it. Like, the IMF is not this super precise organization. Like, there are some Bond films where James Bond is just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm strapped to this table when I got a laser coming
like
at
me. Like I said, as we've discussed, the entirety of Goldfinger is basically Bond, you know, is a de facto IMF agent. Working for MI6.
So Hunley is allowed to Hunley is key in getting the IMF disbanded and absorbed into the CIA, and they are trying to capture Ethan, who Hunley thinks has gone rogue and gone crazy, because there's a specter in this world. Like, this isn't James Bond. There's no specter out there. There's no evil organization.
Yeah, we come to find out in pretty much the next scene with those two that he thinks that Ethan Hunt is causing these things to happen. He's basically he describes him as, you know, the arsonist turned firefighter, essentially, yeah. Like creating these problems so that he can solve them to give himself a purpose.
Which it's kind of wild. We cut back to Ethan, who is chained up in a torture chamber, and he observes some Discord. Syndicate operative and disavowed MI6 agent Ilsa Faust, who is preparing to interrogate Ethan with drugs, is forced to step aside by her colleague Yannick Winter, the bone doctor. He's called this because he has a case full of scary instruments to prove right to his nickname, and he doesn't really do anything with them. The bone doctor looks like some European skinny version of what's Hellboy's name?
His actual name or the actor's name? Yeah,
the actor's name.
Of Ron Perlman?
Yeah, Ron Perlman. Okay. He looks like a skinny version of Ron Perlman to me. I don't know what it is, but so they're in this torture chamber, and Ilsa kind of signals to Ethan like, "Hey, I'm on your side. You know, figure something out and we can get out of here." And Ethan, the bone doctor comes to him, and Ethan kind of fucking shotgun drop kicks him while chained up to a metal chain or to a metal pole with his hands behind his back. And
this whole sequence from Ethan Hunt is, like I said, somehow this is more ridiculous than him hanging off the side of a plane. What happens in this scene?
Like, okay, now every time I see this, he can't open. The key is not long enough for him to open his shackles.
Right, and he's chained around a pole that's, you know, cemented into the ground, essentially like a tall pole that's about 10 feet tall, give or take.
Right, but it has no. It doesn't connect to the ceiling.
Correct.
So Ethan does mid-air kip-ups. That's the only way I can describe it. He does mid-air kip-ups up the pole. He does like three of them. And I'm like, is this Tom Cruise doing this?
It can't be. Or if it is, it's with wired assistance.
It has to be, right? Because, yo, like, it's hard enough to do a kip-up. And now you're doing a kip-up against gravity. Like, I mean,
and then once he gets free of that, he literally, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, he literally Liu Kang bicycle kicks somebody in this scene. Like, he does a running seated drop kick, but his feet are pedaling as he's running through the air. That shit is happening. Like he must, like, while he was sitting on that pole, he must have been holding down low kick the entire fucking time, and then just decided to unleash it once the bad guys needed to get fucked up.
This is wild, man. This is wild. Meanwhile, all this commotion is going on. All this, you know, grunting and punching and kicking, all of this is going on. And the two guards outside the torture chamber, they're like, they're really working him over. I wonder if they're okay.
These two guys are the fucking heavies from Ocean 11. Let's listen to Danny's friend pretend to kick the shit out of him in the boiler room.
Like, this is wild, man. But this is a cool little action scene. And Ilsa Faust helps Ethan escape. And she's like, look, I'm deep cover. You got to get out of here. I can't go with you because I'm in deep cover. So that's how Ethan is able to,
right. Runs down a narrow underground corridor as he's shot at by the bone doctor, who has the marksmanship skills of an Imperial stormtrooper.
Yeah, no kidding. He got an automatic weapon.
Right, and it's a straight shot. Like, it's not even, and he wasn't even far away. Like, there's no reason he should have gotten hit with at least one fucking bullet. Good lord!
I mean, goodness, it's not, and he's not like juking the bullets either. Like, he's just running.
Right, like Ethan does not take off down the hallway until the bone doctor literally turns the corner, and it's not like it's a huge, you know, huge distance between him and between this door and this corner that the bone doctor runs down. So,
my goodness gracious, man! Ethan makes contact with Brandt and. And they're like, look, that Brent gives Ethan the rundown, like IMF has been disbanded and, you know, I work for the CIA now. The CIA director is like, yo, where is he? Where is he at? I know that was you talking to him because we're the CIA. So where is he? And Brent is like, I don't know what you're talking about, man. Cut to 6 months later.
Right, right. Well, the line is like Hundley is monologuing to Brandt, and literally he's like set your watch, Brandt. Ethan Hunt is living his last day as a free man, and then they cut to like the 6 months later, and Ethan is still on the run from the CIA.
So he's on the run. He's in Havana, and there's a little scene of the CIA tracking down Ethan, and it turns out they knocked on the wrong door. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't think
half the world away. As a matter of fact,
no kidding. The CIA is in Havana, and Ethan is actually in Paris.
But they do find his, you know, fucking Charlie Day, you know, connection of all the syndicate operatives and stuff like that that he had set up there.
Carol. yeah, which is funny. I guess he did that on purpose, right? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Not crazy. To prove that he's not crazy. And this is how you prove you're not crazy, by having a bunch of newspaper clippings and psychotic vision boards of trying to connect things together. That proves that you're not crazy, right? And so Ethan's going to need help, right? So we cut to Benji doing just the most blatant product placement I've ever
seen. Oh, no shit. I mean, Microsoft is all over this episode in general. Like forget just, you know, Halo 5 and the Xbox One that you see here. Yeah, they are all over it. They are all over it.
I mean, goodness gracious. So Benji gets a letter saying that he won tickets to an opera. And he has to, but, you know, at the same time, he has to take his weekly polygraph exam to prove that he's legit, doesn't know where Ethan Hunt is. So he makes sure to look at the Xbox controller, and he makes sure to look at the drawer to put the Xbox controller in. And he makes sure that he looks at that Halo 5 disc box, because Halo 5 is sponsoring this scene. And so Benji goes in, he takes a polygraph, right? He has to take a polygraph every week to prove that he's not like in cahoots with Ethan. And he does a good job of lying. He's like, look, that guy, you know, I'm stuck here with you because of that guy. We're not cool. We are not friends. And Benji was able to lie his way out of it. And he's just like, fuck this shit, man. I'm tired of playing Halo 5 on the job. I'm going to the opera.
Man, please bless me with the energy to get off work on a Friday and just kind of dip over to Austria to go watch Turned on a whim.
Right, because like, it would be one thing if they were like based in Europe. You know,
yeah,
you just kind of take the train somewhere.
Like, no, you literally had to take like a 9-hour flight to get over there.
So, Ethan arranges for Benji to attend an opera in Vienna to search for Solomon Lane, who is a big bad of this film. And Ethan suspects that he is the leader of the syndicate. I don't think at this point he knows his name.
No, he does not. He just knows his face from the one time that they met with one another. By the way, I am shocked that anyone decided they wanted to rip off anything from Quantum of Solace. But I guess if you're going to do it, like having a huge, you know, spy operation at a, you know, luxurious opera house would be the thing to do.
There you go. So Benji arrives in Vienna, and he's given a bunch of gadgets and instructions by Hunt, and they arrive at the Vienna State Opera, where the Chancellor of Australia is attending a performance of some play.
It's Turandot. is okay. what it is. So pretty famous opera. So
oh well, I'm uncultured swine.
Ethan spots Ilsa, but decides to go after a different syndicate operative because it appears that people are trying to murder the Chancellor of Austria. And this whole scene, this scene is a nice little, like, Mission Impossible style action scene where it's a lot of physical comedy juxtaposed with like seriousness, like someone is about to be assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And like in spy movie fashion, they are about to be assassinated when someone hits a high note so that you don't hear the gunshot and all that. Like that's, you know, I like that stuff. I'm a sucker for that stuff.
And I will say too, so like at this point we still don't know what Ilsa's deal is. And I can't think of another spy movie that kept you guessing to the motives of like the mysterious ally agent the way that this one does. And for as long as they do too, because even in Bond films where he has kind of had like the reluctant partner, usually about a third of the way in, by the time we get to act two, it's very clear that, you know, that person and Bond are on the same side, just playing for different teams, but working to the same goal. But they literally force us to get to like the third act in this movie before we have a much clearer sense of what Ilsa is, what her objectives are in this film.
This scene is cool. They're fighting in the rafters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Ethan is fighting, you know, he's being fed information from Benji. And Ethan is fighting one of these dudes on the rafters, and at one point they do like the wrestling test of strength, right? they got their hands on top of each other, and they both start, you know, from a kneeling position, and they both slowly stand up, and then Tom Cruise stands up, and then the other guy just keeps going up and up and up, and I like this because at the same time, like, Ethan is like super agent, but at the same time, like, he's not, like, he's like Nathan Drake, where Nathan Drake can like do anything and he can climb on anything, but every once in a while he trips over his own feet.
Right. Or either that, or it's, or, you know, a dude that's like 7 feet tall comes along that he actually has to try. Right. To kick ass.
Right.
Let's also not, you know, gloss over the fact that this guy has a sniper rifle, like, disguised as a flute, essentially, that he's trying to kill this dude with. So
I love it. I love it. eventually, Ethan gets the upper hand. And we're getting to this high note, right? And Ethan sees Ilsa lining up her shot. Ethan sees another syndicate agent lining up his shot.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethan's like, well, he sees that they're both targeting the Chancellor of Austria. So he's like, well, what do I do? You know, so at the high note, because he, you know, he figured out that the high note is where the shot is going to take place. At the high note, he's like, I got to get the Chancellor to move because I can't kill two of these people at the same time. And whereas James Bond would kind of figure out how to kill both of them at the same time,
mm-hmm.
Ethan is like, I'm going to shoot the Chancellor. I'm going to give him a flesh wound. I'm going to graze him to make him flinch so that the other two will miss their shot.
Yeah, he does the Jack Travis.
Yeah.
He shoots the hostage.
Yeah. which is cool, man. That was cool. You know, he's a thinking man. He's not just a brute. He's a thinking man's spy. And then they all have to kind of escape because the plan has gone awry.
Mm-hmm.
And
meanwhile, Benji fights one of the other would-be assassins in the control room, and Ilsa is able to save him by shooting that guy as well. So.
Yeah, and he's like, she tried to shoot me. He's like, yo, shut up, yo. I'm trying to save your ass. Ethan and Ilsa meet up, and they're like, let's get out of here. And Eventually they get to like the top of the, they get to the top of the opera house,
mm-hmm.
and they just grab a rope and just like swing down.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't go out the front door.
No.
Because, you know, we're spies. We gotta do it up. And it turns out all that was for nothing.
Yeah, because the chancellor's car has a bomb attached to it, or has a bomb in it, because it's in a briefcase, so within now, the car.
I get that this is supposed to make Solomon seem like a genius, right? Mm-hmm. Because he has all these redundancies, and I get that, you know, he's trying to test Ilsa's loyalty,
mm-hmm.
so he gave her a mission, but he has redundancies. But do you need, like, all right, if you... Do you need the two other dudes?
Look, I for one think that James Bond villains could take notes from Solomon Lane. Like, you you know, because the famous thing with the James Bond villain is that they generally put all of their eggs into one basket. But yeah. Solomon Lane actually has contingency plans. Like I said, he has three separate plans, essentially, for this one mission to be carried
out. Yeah, and I'm saying maybe just have one contingency. You know, I mean, I don't know how much money the syndicate has to just throw around to pay these people, but, you know, he's got Ilsa, right? That's the test. And then you got one contingency that Ethan kind of took care of. Okay. But then you got the second guy, who's the second contingency. And then you got the 100% insurance policy with the bomb. I'm saying that second guy didn't need to be there.
Maybe so.
You know, I'll help you out, Solomon. I know an accountant. But yeah, it all for not, because the chancellor's car blew up. I forget the reason why the chancellor was supposed to die.
I don't know if they really detail that, because Ethan does a good job of detailing all the other stuff that Lane did. And what effect it had on the global, you know, world order of things, I guess. But yeah, I guess they don't get into it here. Perhaps because, I don't know, maybe we don't yet see what his ultimate plan is for this here, so.
Dunn picks up the two agents, but Ilsa leaves them after dropping hints of the syndicate's plan in an attempt to maintain her cover. Hunt explains that the syndicate consists entirely of disavowed operatives from around the world and are responsible for the assassinations and disappearances of many of the world's leaders and the subsequent civil wars. Maybe that's it. Maybe mm-hmm. he's trying to just cause terror. Well, he's obviously trying to cause terror, but maybe specifically for a civil war. Yeah, this scene is where Benji's like, I'm a field agent now, and I'm gonna help no matter what. Ilsa goes back to bad guy HQ, and Solomon Lane, who has just the weirdest voice.
He does. It really like I was wondering if that was like a conscious choice. I think it is. I don't think the actor actually sounds like that, so
I mean it's very different. You know, normally you hear, you know, actors who are villains try their damnedest to sound evil. Like, you know, I'm a bad guy. They all want to sound like Dr. Claw.
Well, he does. I mean, he is kind of Blofeld-y, though, in some ways. Like this film, among all of the Mission Impossible films, definitely feels the most Bondian, which is probably why we like it as much as we do, honestly.
Yeah.
But yeah, he like this villain I could easily see. I mean, he's even wearing a Nehru jacket, for Christ's sake. Like, he's wearing yeah. the fucking Dr. No jacket.
So Ilsa goes to Solomon and it's basically like, you know, what happened? Like, you failed me for the last time, don't fail me again, basically. Tell me what Ethan knows, and I'll give you one last shot to prove your worth, to prove your loyalty. We cut to Casablanca, and we see Ethan and Benji in Casablanca, and they meet up with Ilsa, and Ilsa helps Hunt break into the syndicate's Moroccan base to recover a ledger belonging to the syndicate. I think they are skipping.
They're skipping a bunch. So basically, she wanted Ethan to find her because she needs to employ Ethan's help in order to, like you said, find this ledger that has the syndicate's like duty roster, I guess you could say. But it's in this just ridiculously secure server that has like, you know, an ID card check, like a password. It has like three different combination dial locks you have to pass. But the big problem is that there's a body scanner that is able to somehow memorize the physical profiles of authorized personnel in order to access this thing, like down to their gait, down to, you know, their heartbeats, things like that, that it's impossible to get past, essentially. So they can't just put a mask on and roll. They literally have to put Benji's, you know, profile into this system. The only way to do that is in a liquid cooled array that is far below the secure facility that they're trying to access. And it can only be it's completely flooded as well. Like you have to actually go in there and do this underwater. But also, oh by the way, you can't have it like the tunnel that it's in is secured from metal. Like if it shuts down if it detects any metal. So you can't have like scuba gear or a rebreather or anything. So you literally have to like free dive and hold your breath and do this. And it takes like 5 minutes or 4 minutes or however long they say it does.
So they're doing, you know, they're describing the impossible mission. And Benji's like, and Benji just basically explained all that you just did.
Yeah.
And then Benji goes and is like, yeah, well, all you have to do really is hold your breath for 3 minutes. It's like, wait, I got to hold my breath for 3 minutes? It's like, well, and then it takes a couple minutes to, you know, actually do the actual work to swap out the profile. So, yeah, just hold your breath for 5 minutes. What? So, yeah, that's the mission. And Benji's like, whatever, yo. This isn't impossible. I mean, it might be a little difficult, but it's not impossible. We can do this. So.
Meanwhile, Brant enlists Luther's help to try to track down Ethan, try to figure out where he is in the world. And Luther, intelligently, doesn't try to find Ethan because he knows that Ethan will be too difficult to find. But he does try to find Ilsa because they have Ethan's sketch that he made of Ilsa. And he said, and they say because the sketch is so detailed that he's met her and talked to her and knows her. And Luther finds her in like 5 minutes and figures out that they're in Morocco.
Yeah, Luther was like, I could have did this while I was at home. You didn't have to call me all the way out here, man.
As someone who has done a lot of work that could have been done at home. At his actual job. I can empathize with Luther here.
So this is the big act two action sequence. This is the one of the impossible missions. Benji is going up and they have to time it so that the profile is switched right as Benji gets into, you know, wherever he needs to go. And Ethan Hunt is underwater. The current carries him to where he needs to be. He starts to do the work, and then all of a sudden, something hits him, and he loses the profiles. Right?
Like, yeah, it's like the data arm. They kind of did this. They would do this later, to some extent, in like Rogue One when they're trying to access like the Death Star plans.
Yeah.
In that weird tower. But yeah, he doesn't pay attention, and the robot arm that I guess accesses these profiles can access the data within the thing like knocks him out, and both of the profiles drop to the ground. Here's where the luck comes into play, because Tom Cruise Ethan has no way to know which one is the one that he needs to put into the server, essentially.
But lucky for him, he is able to get it done. Now, They do the profile. They retrieve the ledger.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this scene is like I said, if any filmmaker wants a lesson in tension building, there's no music in this scene at all. It's just the sound effects. You know, the parts where Ethan is in on the underwater thing, like pretty much all you can hear is the whir of like the server and his heartbeat.
Yeah.
Essentially, like that's very effective. You know, like Benji is kind of freaked out the entire time. Like you said, like Ethan puts in the profile, like at literally the last second that would be needed for Benji not to get caught, essentially. But then Ethan runs out of oxygen, like his life bar goes down to zero. and so he passes out and we are meant to think that he might have drowned. But then Ilsa actually is there to save the day. She's able to gather him, open the like exhaust port, I guess, yeah. or the outtake port for this chamber, and get them out of there. So,
Benji's able to get the ledger, and he opens a car door by putting his hand on the window, which is weird.
I wouldn't like that. Technology. Dirty up my window.
Yeah, so. Like, door handles exist for a reason,
right? Guys. And they have keyless entry on door handles. Like you can just code your fingerprint to that little black dot that's on your driver door.
Right. So okay. we cut to Ilsa and Ethan. Ethan is suffering some mild brain damage
again. this is the second time in a Mission Impossible movie that he has literally died before being resurrected.
But he comes to, and Benji's there, and he's like, "See, I told you we could do it." And Ilsa is changing her clothes, and the two of them aren't paying attention, and Ilsa sees that Benji has the ledger on a flash drive, and she knocks him out. She's like, "Yoink!" And she takes it, and she gets out of there. And
she hits him with a defibrillator.
She defibrillates. And so now we got a chase scene.
What a crazy chase sequence this is.
So meanwhile, Brant and Luther are there. They're in this big like SUV or whatever, and they're trying to find him. Ilsa hops on a motorcycle. She makes sure to put that helmet on just in case. So you can make sure that the stunt driver.
Meanwhile, she's getting like she's already kind of suspicious of this like group of syndicate guys that were sent to intercept her, because you know Lane hasn't exactly made her feel the most comfortable, and of course because you know just to dissuade her suspicions, they all stare at her menacingly as she's getting ready to get the bike set up. So she basically knocks all the bikes out before she takes off down the road.
Yeah. Ethan, who is still not quite altogether there, insists on getting in this BMW and chasing after Ilsa. Ilsa, who is on a motorcycle, is able to ride down some steps, right? Some wide, you know, steps. And Ethan, who is, you know, normally a super spy, able to do anything. He's brain damaged a little bit. So he's just kind of going all over the place. And Benji's freaked out. Neither one of them has their seatbelt on. and yeah, this chase scene is kind of fun, man. Especially with Ethan being like out of it. At one point they see, Brant and Luther. And
right. Who are looking for them in Morocco.
I was like, "Hey, we were looking for you." And Brant and Luther, ever the odd couple, they're trying to go after them. They're bickering about the big SUV that they have because, you know, they're chasing a sports car and a sports sedan and a bunch of motorcycles. And they're in a Range Rover, so not a lot of maneuverability. But Anything else about this action scene that you want to talk about?
Oh, it's like I said, it hits a lot of great beats. Like Ethan and Brant kind of work to take out the motorcycle gang following Ilsa. And then eventually it ends with the BMW reversing and going through one of the most insane like car flip sequences that you'll ever see in your entire life. Like it literally flips end over end backwards throughout this parking lot, essentially lands on its roof. And then you get the comedic thing of, you know, one of the like the last dude of the motorcycle gang or one of the last guys like pulls up next to the car. Ethan and Benji are stuck in the car. They're trying to get their seatbelts off so they can get out. This dude's probably going to kill them. And then all of a sudden you see the Range Rover like pull up and fucking throw that guy like across the goddamn parking lot.
Just when you think this action sequence is over. No, that was just part one. Part two is just a straight up, you know, motorcycle chase between Ilsa and Ethan. And it's a cool motorcycle chase. I like the end of it where Ethan is coming around a bend and all of a sudden Ilsa on you know, off the bike, just walks out into traffic because she hears Ethan coming.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows that Ethan's not going to hit her. So Ethan gets startled. He doesn't want to hit her.
He's right. He throws the bike.
Yeah. Throws the bike off. And then she's just like, that was easy.
Well, like I said, so between the server infiltration situation, the initial car chase and the crash that him and Benji went through, and then laying down the bike going, you know, at super high speeds while not wearing any like protective gear. Like he's not wearing a motorcycle jacket. He doesn't have a helmet on. He doesn't have any like knee pads or anything like that on. I think Ethan Hunt might have endured more trauma in a 15-minute span than anyone else in the history of humanity. and emerges relatively unscathed.
Yeah.
Maybe I got to pop a few ibuprofen, but other than that.
By the time he wakes up from the third concussion that he's had from flying off of the motorcycle, he's all good. And the team, the IMF team, they go back to like a safe house and they're like, what do we do now? And Ethan's like, yo, please, please, please tell me you made a copy of all that data. And Benji looks at him disappointed and then he smiles and he's like, of course I made a copy. I'm Benji. I'm a tech guy. That's what I do. I always make copies of stuff. We're in the spy game, baby. I understand what's going on. Ilsa returns to London and attempts to pass a drive containing the syndicate ledger to her handler, MI6 director Attlee, who compels Ilsa to return to the syndicate and finish her mission.
This is is this them taking a playful shot at Bond by making basically an M character, but he's a giant piece of shit?
Yeah, but essentially. He's a fucking dickhead. Yeah. yeah, this is a little back and forth that they do.
Like this dude even looks like an older version of Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah. I know where they are. When we went to London, they're sitting right across from Parliament, and we walked down there because our hotel was on that side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked down there and I was like, oh, this was in Mission Impossible 5, babe. And my wife is just like, huh, what? Okay, whatever.
Like, hey, sit on this bench. I'll be Director Attlee and you can be Ilsa Fest. Like, look at us. We're looking at the Tims. It's right here. There it is.
So she eventually returns to Lane only to find out that Attlee has wiped the drive, which in fact contained an encrypted red box. A red box is a data safe programming, a data safe programmed by the British government. Unlocking it requires the Prime Minister's biometrics. The former IMF agents confront Ilsa, but when Lane's men abduct, they are.
Well, first she meets Lane and crew in a cemetery, where they are authenticating the drive, and they come to find out that it's empty. She realizes what happened, once that happens. And now Lane is pretty much done with her. But he also figures, I'm assuming he figures that Ethan, did he think, well, he needs her to get Ethan, basically. So he wants to get Ethan. I think Ethan reveals to her when they meet at Heathrow that he made a copy of the drive. And Lane, of course, can hear this because he sent her to talk to him. So they're talking in the airport. She proposes that her and Ethan, like, run away together instead of, you know, do all this stuff. Because she's like, hey, actually, you're in a no-win situation. You know, Lane correctly surmises that Hunt is a gambler. And so he's going to, even in a no-win situation, like, he's still going to try to beat the odds. Because, you know, that he has Ethan figured out. And in the commotion that's going on, Lane's people are able to kidnap Benji. And then Ilsa, as Hunt gives chase to try to figure out what happened to Benji, Ilsa is able to sneak away, essentially.
Yeah, they tell Luther to watch the spy. They tell Luther, the guy who's not a field agent, the guy who is about the size of two field agents, they tell him to watch the super spy. And
by the way, Heathrow can't be this like, I understand it's a busy airport in a major metropolitan city. It can't be this packed with people walking back and forth at all times, can it? like with this level of consistency. You've been there, so you can tell
it
me.
It wasn't like this. this is a little ridiculous. But I don't know. Maybe they came in on, like, maybe they did this on Thanksgiving, the busiest travel day of the year. Oh, but it wouldn't matter because it's Heathrow. Like, they don't celebrate Thanksgiving over there. So yeah,
no, they certainly don't.
So yeah, I don't know why it's that busy, but certainly it's busy. But it's certainly not busy enough for her to Batman out of there in broad daylight. You know what I mean? So there's the team realize that Benji's kidnapped and they gotta figure out something to do. So Brandt, they come up with a plan. So Brandt contacts CIA Director Hunley.
And again, they do a good job here of planting the seeds of doubt because Hunt and team figure out that, well, once they figure out what they have, once they figure out that it's a red box that can only be unlocked by the British Prime Minister, they correctly surmise that Lane is going to try to kidnap the British Prime Minister. Yeah. And Benji from the get-go is like, this is a terrible plan. Like, we need to alert the British government. Like, what the fuck are you doing? And Ethan's like, no, we have to draw Lane out into the open. It's the only way that we can get Lane. Like Ethan is being completely ridiculous, I feel like, in this situation.
Yeah. We have to put this guy's life in danger.
Right. But he's like, this is the closest that I've ever been to catching this guy, and if we let him get away, I'm probably never gonna get this close again. So, like, this is our one shot to fucking get this dude. So they do a good job again of planting the seed of doubt, making you wonder if Benji is truly on board. And he appears to sneak off, like you said, and call Hundley to alert him as to what is going on so that Hundley will come to London to chase after them, essentially.
Yeah. So they eventually arrive at a charity auction in Oxfordshire to try and prevent Hunt from attacking the Prime Minister and take him with Brandt and Attlee into a secure room. They take the Prime Minister to a secure room with Brandt and Attlee. Brandt has the Prime Minister confirm the existence of the syndicate.
So we come to find out that the syndicate was kind of a brainchild of Attlee, of recruiting disavowed agents from other places and offering operating in, like, a black ops style and manner, yeah, to advance the interests of the British government. And the Prime Minister, who was, you know, who he brought this to, was like, this is a fucking terrible idea. Like, it basically puts a lot of power, you know, unilaterally into my hands, and with no oversight or no accountability. He's like, so don't do this. Attlee told him that it was basically a training exercise that he had formed, but it turns out that Attlee had actually, you know, created this program which has all of these and created this ledger, which how much money did they say it was? Like $2 billion or like $2.5 billion in untraceable offshore accounts.
Yeah.
Essentially, which is what's on this disk drive that Lane is trying to get.
Yeah.
And I like how the MI6 director is like, hey, maybe we should create our own impossible mission force. And the prime minister is like, no, what are you, crazy?
But meanwhile, so and this is where the speech comes in. So like, you know, Hundley is talking to the prime minister, who's being like, we have to get out of here. Let's fucking roll. And he's like, no, I think you should actually stay right where you are. And this is this is where the speech happens, where he basically pumps up Ethan Hunt to an amazing degree.
Help me to understand. Who is this man? Why is he after me?
I'm afraid, Prime Minister, Director Hundley and I share responsibility for this.
Ethan Hunt was part of a disgraced intelligence agency which has since been dissolved.
And he's gone rogue, unfortunately intent on dismantling an imaginary terror network.
But new intelligence suggests that he's been manipulated by one of your own former agents.
Ilse Faust, Prime Minister, she disappeared 2 years ago.
And if you don't mind my asking, what do I have to do with this phantom network?
Sir, this is William Brandt, a former colleague of Hunt's. He came forward with first-hand knowledge of the plot against you.
Sir, Hunt is in possession of a virtual red box that can only be opened by you. He believes it is the key to bring down the syndicate.
The syndicate, you say?
Yes, sir. That's what he calls it.
Atlee, he couldn't possibly be talking about that syndicate. Because you assured me that that syndicate was merely an exercise.
And it was, Prime Minister. I can assure you.
And yet here we have the Central Intelligence Agency indicating otherwise.
I don't understand.
Prime Minister, your life is in danger. I think our first priority is to move you to a secure location.
Does the name Solomon Lane ring a bell?
Yes. Unfortunately, it does.
So there actually is a syndicate?
It was the hypothetical brainchild of Chief Atlee. Recruit former agents from other nations, supply them with a new identity, and use them to surgically remove our enemies both at home and abroad. Its operating budget was to be hidden offshore in a virtual red box, which I alone would control. It would have made me judge, jury, and executioner with zero accountability. I rejected the proposal unequivocally. Furthermore, I was given every assurance it never passed the planning stage.
Prime Minister, there is no syndicate. These men have been duped by Agent Faust.
Atlee, save it for the public inquiry.
Sir, I urge you not to leave this room.
Excuse me.
Please. Hunt is uniquely trained and highly motivated. A specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. There is no secret he cannot extract, no security he cannot breach, no person he cannot become. He has most likely anticipated this very conversation and is waiting to strike in whatever direction we move. Sir, Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny, and he has made you his mission.
Prime Minister.
Basically, the payoff line is Ethan Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny.
Yo, come on, yo.
And he's going to get you, so you better watch out. Only to turn around and see Chief Atlee holding a tranquilizer gun, who shoots the prime minister, and he pulls off the mask to reveal that it was Ethan all along.
And Alec Baldwin's read of that one word. Ethan pulls off his mask to reveal that it's Ethan. The camera zooms in on Hundley, and he's just like, Hunt. And it's just the funniest thing to me, man. Like, it's like he's so shocked, but it doesn't, like, I can't take it seriously. Like, because Alec Baldwin, like you said, is funny.
And it just Hunt. Like, I don't know, man. It's just a funny, it's just a funny push in, man. It's a funny push in, and we see it's him. Like, I don't know. It just makes me laugh. Hunley, Atlee reveals himself as Hunley in disguise, or Atlee reveals himself as Hunt in disguise, yes, and subdues the prime minister to secure his biometrics. When the real Atlee arrives, he approaches two more dummies guarding a door, and they're like, "Yeah, wait a minute. You told us that we aren't supposed to let you in, so you coming up here telling us to let you in? I can't do that." Well, who told you that? Well, you did, huh?
Meanwhile, the IMF is getting the prime minister, who is under drug influence, essentially, like he's in like a truth serum, I guess, to basically unlock the red box for them. So, like I said, there's a fingerprint scan, there's a retinal scan, and then there's a voice print that they have to get done.
Yeah. So everything comes out right. The syndicate was created without prime minister's permission, but Solomon Lane ended up hijacking the project for his own ends, and he went rogue. Atlee has been desperately trying to cover it up, covering up the existence of it, including using Faust. Atlee is arrested, and Hunt, having Hunley take the credit for subduing him. Like, hey, congratulations, you just saved the prime minister.
Yeah, like I said, he also truth serums the Atlee as well. And basically kind of creates the scene for Hunley to take advantage, because he's like, and Hunley, he's like, "You saved the prime minister's life when Atlee attacked him." And the prime minister's like in the corner, he's like, "That's true. He did attack me." Like, well, cuz as far as he knows, he did. Like I said, cuz Hunt was dressed as Atlee.
Shit. So Luther discovers that the file is not a ledger of agents, but contains the location and access codes for £2.4 billion of untraceable funds and a video message from Atlee confirming the syndicate's activation, that Lane has been desperate to get to expand and camouflage the syndicate's operations. Hunt, who is a genius apparently, destroys the file and heads to the meeting at the Tower of London.
You are glossing over how this happens. So it's true that when you're like a spy, when you do stuff like this, that you learn to memorize like long sequences of numbers and things like that, because you need that, you know, when you're working in espionage and things of that nature, because of file names and stuff like that. We're meant to believe that Ethan Hunt basically like stares at a computer screen for like 5 minutes, is somehow able to memorize the account numbers and access codes and sorting codes for like 50 accounts, basically, that each have tens of millions of dollars in them or pounds in them. And then he takes the drive and drills through it, destroying it.
Right.
So he's doing this so that he has something to offer Lane, and maybe he didn't memorize all of them. Like maybe he only did like the first couple just to show Lane that he was serious.
I like to think that he memorized.
I would like to think that as well, because like I said, he's a Superman. Because,
you know, when you read, you know, you normally just keep your head still and read. But when you're super reading and memorizing, you're moving your head back and forth, and you're moving your eyes and your head back and forth. That's how you know that he's reading and memorizing. I like to think that he did it. He was able to do it. He was able to memorize 50 account codes. Meanwhile, I can barely remember my own account code, but that's neither here nor there.
So, like I said, now we have Lane, who's coordinating the final confrontation at an outdoor restaurant at like 11 p.m. This restaurant looks amazingly crowded for 11 p.m. in the evening, even in London. But Ilse's there. Benji's there. Benji's sitting with a bomb strapped to his chest. He's also acting as Lane's communicator, his go-between. Lane has a camera contact lens in his eye and is telling Benji what to say. And Benji's sitting on like a motion plate, so if he gets up, then you know, everything will, you know, everyone will be killed in the area. The syndicate dudes are there to make sure that Ethan and Ilsa don't run away or anything like that. And Elaine's going to kill Ilsa and Ethan as well, unless Ethan gives him what he wants.
Benji is doing a very good job of being a translator because, you know, he's literally saying every single word, like, good evening, Mr. Hunt. Not like, yeah, he's saying hello. Like, no, he's saying good evening, Mr. Hunt, and I need you to do, like, and he's doing it with, like, the proper inflection and tone. He's a very good translator for someone who's about to get blown up.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Ethan had like there's a timer strapped to his chest as well. So Ethan has to make this happen within like 3 minutes, essentially.
Yeah. He convinces Lane that he memorized the data. I don't know how he proved it to him.
Oh, he proved it to him by basically giving him writing down one of the account numbers.
He wrote down one of the numbers.
Right. And showed it to him on a napkin. And when Lane punched it in, like, he's like, oh, congratulations, you just got $30 million. And he's like, holy shit. Like this guy is fucking serious. And like, it literally takes Lane until the last second to disarm the bomb, essentially.
Yeah. It was like 1/1900ths of a second.
Right. Like Ethan's whole thing is that Lane has prepared for every eventuality, but he didn't prepare for this. Like, he didn't expect Ethan to basically become the list, and so now Ethan can't be killed because otherwise Lane will lose his money that he's worked so hard to get.
In a series that has an over reliance of MacGuffins, it is pretty impressive that they decided that Ethan Hunt will be the MacGuffin.
$50 million to let Benji go.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing. Right now, you're saying it's bluff. I'd never let my friends die. I couldn't possibly memorize the entire disc. There's only one way to be sure. Let Benji go. They come one step closer. Shoot me.
Stop. You remember I told you one day you were going to take things too far? This is me speaking, by the way. It's not him.
The only way this ends is you and me, Lane, face to face. Only this time I won't be locked in a glass box. You want your money? The bone doctor's going to have to beat it out of me. Now let Benji go.
And he literally, like as Lane has his dudes kind of move in on the restaurant, like, Ethan has Ilsa put a gun to his stomach and is like, hey, if they come a step closer, shoot me. and so Lane for the first time is in a situation where he doesn't know what to do. Like, he the tables have been turned on him. He does not have a contingency plan, and he has to get Ethan Hunt back alive. So Ethan gets Benji gets Lane to release Benji. I also like it too, where like you mentioned, Benji was doing a great job being a translator. He's like, and Benji, like, as Ethan is like doing this shit, he's just like, I always told you, and this is me talking, by the way, I always told you that you would take it too far one of these days.
I like how after Benji is, you know, they disable the bomb, right? The bone doctor is like, what are my orders? And he's like, go get him and bring Ethan back alive, right? So they start pulling out their guns and they start shooting. And Ilsa, you know, she takes shot. And then Ethan, the MacGuffin, is like, oh, they can't shoot me, so I'm just going to get in the line of fire for you. Like, it was cool, man. Like he used himself as a bulletproof vest for her.
And so they slip away. Now it's a foot chase.
Yeah,
with the syndicate chasing after Ethan and Ilsa.
And the chase is pretty cool. You get a couple of moments here. Ilsa gets her her moment with the bone collector or whatever his
name. The bone doctor. I would have called him the bone collector as well, but that is not he is not Lincoln Rhymes or whatever the fuck that dude's name is. So
they have a knife fight, which is cool.
They do. She stabs the shit out of him too. Like she does the thing where she does like this mounted like head scissors and just fucking starts like going to town on him.
That's cool, man.
And meanwhile, Lane finally emerges from his apartment to chase after a injured Ethan as he chases him through this construction site, essentially.
Yeah. And eventually they lure Solomon Lane into a trap set up by Brandt and Luther. And it's the same trap that the syndicate used to capture Hunt. They put him in a glass box of emotion. And now here's my question about the glass box.
Right.
Lane falls into the glass box, and the glass box is bulletproof. How do we know it's bulletproof? Because Lane takes his gun and shoots at the glass at, you know, the people outside at point blank range. Right. Now, I'm not a physicist, right? I've shot guns, but I haven't shot guns into bulletproof objects, right?
Okay.
If you shoot this gun at the glass, isn't the bullet just gonna ricochet inside the thing?
No. Bulletproof glass is basically designed, it's not bulletproof like it's impenetrable. It's designed to absorb the bullet, essentially. It's designed to absorb the energy that the bullet displaces. So, like, the bullet will puncture the bulletproof glass. It's eating the bullet. It punctures the glass, but the glass is generally so thick and treated that the energy, I guess, just disperses throughout the glass itself and stops the bullet from going through. Like, if you've ever been to a bank, like, the glass in front of a bank teller is, like, it's literally, like, 2 inches thick. And that doesn't seem like a lot, but considering how thick regular glass is that you can fire a bullet through, it's significantly thicker than that.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So no, it's not like it's, you know, it's not like it's made of, you know, impenetrable metal that the bullet will just, you know, bounce around inside the fucking thing where you shoot it. Like, you know, it just kind of eats the bullet, essentially.
Okay. All right. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
And they gas him. They gas his ass.
He does have a very dramatic like the music swelling, and he disappears into the fucking the fog of gas, and all of a sudden he boom, you know, he suddenly appears through the fog, just to have a dramatic last shot as the IMF team kind of stands around staring at him.
I like to think that's just him being a dick.
I think so too. He's the guy that, you know, that you know, when you play him, you know, in Tecmo Bowl, he always beats you. But then, like, the one time where you beat him, like, he starts acting like an asshole and is like, the game's cheating, and fucking unplugs his controller. Like, that's who Solomon Lane is.
So, they got the bad guy, and they're back in D.C., and Hunley and Brandt return to the Oversight Committee to try and reinstate the IMF. And
they play it off like, oh, like, no, all of this was a coordination effort between the CIA and IMF the entire time. Like, it was necessary to disband the IMF so that Ethan could operate, you know, without, like, in complete darkness. Like, it's so fucking funny, the shit that they're able to go up to Congress and be like, this is the actual plan.
Right,
we're geniuses. This
is, and look, this is the most accurate depiction of government at work I've ever seen, man. Most of my jobs I've worked for local government and federal government, and this is exactly what happens. People don't like government is not this well-oiled machine, man. It is a bunch of people who are just kind of covering their own ass and making mistakes and playing it off, man. Like this is hilarious to me. I got a special kind of kick out of them bullshitting right. their way into reinstating the IMF.
Right, and the film ends with Brandt and Hundley walking out of the hearing room, and Brandt says to Hundley, "Welcome to the IMF, Mr. Secretary." and then that's it. And we roll credits.
Roll credits, man.
What a fun fucking movie.
It is, man. It's a fun movie. I love watching this movie. Like you said, I think it's the most Bond-ish of Mission Impossible movies. And yeah, man, I loved it.
It's like I said, it's too much fun. Even though it is ridiculous at many points. It's still very enjoyable. There's not really, I mean, the only critique that I would have of the film is that they kind of revert to, you know, Ethan, Benji, Brandt, and Luther kind of hanging around figuring out what are we going to do now? Like kind of, probably one too many times. Like there's three of those scenes in a 20-minute span. You probably could have cut one of those out, yeah. I feel like. But again, especially the first time you watch the movie, it kept you guessing the entire time. The plot didn't feel cheap. It didn't feel stupid. Like this is a difficult movie to follow the first time that you watch it. There's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of like deep espionage stuff. And a lot of times the reveal of the plot can be a letdown, or how you get to the end can feel cheap or feel unearned. But I feel like in this case, they did a really good job. The thing that changed the major ending was that Lane was supposed to be killed by Ethan. And they decided that that they didn't want to do that. It didn't feel like the right ending to the movie for Ethan to kill Lane. It was much more of a logical comeuppance to have Ethan capture Lane in the same way that he was captured. And again, that lends itself well because when we review Mission Impossible Fallout, Solomon Lane figures heavily, and the Syndicate figures heavily into the plot of that film as well. So like you said, you called the Syndicate the Mission Impossible version of Spectre. That very much comes to fruition in the next movie. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's great. Like you said, everyone kind of knows their role at this point. You know, and Ethan Hunt is peak Ethan Hunt in this one. We didn't get bogged down by the wife subplot in this one. This is the only one of the last of the final four films so far that have come out that doesn't get bogged down there.
Yeah.
It's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah, man. I love it. Next month, we will be back. We will do another James Bond episode. I don't know if we've decided what we're going to do yet, but...
we have not, but we will.
Yeah, we'll be back next month with another James Bond episode. And after that, we'll do Mission Impossible Fallout. That's the last Mission Impossible movie for now. So we'll have to think of another franchise or another.
Well, spy movie. Here's the thing though. After we review Fallout, the next episode after that is probably going to be the review of a little film called No Time to Die.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you've heard of it, James Bond fan. I don't know if you've heard of that movie, but the 25th James Bond movie is coming out. So I'm super excited.
Yeah,
I saw the Super Bowl preview, and it got me all excited all over again.
Well, like I said, I don't know when the screener is for that film. I hope that you and I get to see it together because I think that would be a lot of fun if we were able to pull that off.
I'm going to demand that we see it together. So we'll see. But until then, the men with the golden tongues will return.